Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the expected conviction in the same Moscow court that railroaded oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky of the three young women of the punk rock group Pussy Riot. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and author of the forthcoming book The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulags of the Mind, joins us to discuss a trial Khodorkovsky has described as a medieval inquisition. Then we'll assess the meeting that took place today between the embattled Syrian dictator and Iran's national security chief Saeed Jalili, who pledged Iran's support for its vital partner. Nada Hashimi, a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics, joins us to discuss what Iran can do to save the Assad regime and what is likely to happen to the captured so-called Iranian pilgrims rumored to be members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Then finally, we will look into the world's largest operator of private clinics and hospitals, the Hospital Corporation of America, HCA, that again is under scrutiny for performing unnecessary and expensive procedures that endanger patients and defraud the taxpayer. Dr. Evan Weissman, a retired cardiologist, joins us to discuss the latest charges against HCA, who previously paid out $1.7 billion in fines for defrauding the government in 2000. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, and she was a research fellow at the School of Historical Studies of the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton University and served as deputy editor of East European Constitutional Review at the NYU School of Law. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She is currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And these three young women of the rock group Pussy Riot, which I have to say is, I think, one of the cleverest names. You're forced into saying it all the time. And, you know, we're constrained here by six words we can't say, but that apparently is not one of them. The prosecutor in the case, who's asking for, I think, a three-year jail sentence today, described these young women as dangerous feminists. How does that strike you?
Well, that says it all. I mean, Russia in the 21st century talks about protest and dissent and very clever wording of these three very young women as dangerous feminists. I mean, you know, and Vladimir Putin's reaction is also very interesting, because when he commented on this, he said that in some other places, this woman wouldn't even get to the lawyer or to trial because they would be prosecuted immediately, basically getting death. And that just says it all, because Russia clearly sees itself not as a country, modern country of the 21st century, which I want to remind everybody is situated in Europe, but the country of some medieval makeup, that we're still comparing ourselves to very backward patriarchal systems where women and their freedom of speech is considered to be very dangerous.
Well, it also paradoxically has echoes of the Republican primary campaign, where Rick Santorum was making similar statements. I mean, I understand your analogy to, say, Russia comparing their legal system to that of Saudi Arabia, where these young women would have already been beheaded. But that's that's hardly a yardstick of civilization.
Right. And it's, of course, it's hardly an original statement either. But we just have to remember also that Rick Santorum dropped out of the campaign and is basically is a distant memory at this point. And in Russia, it is the president of Russia who has been in the Kremlin or around the Kremlin for 12 years now makes this kind of statement. So not that these things do not exist in other countries or in the United States, for that matter, but there is still a choice, and there is a kind of counterbalance, at least in the, certainly in the United States. And in Russia, there is no counterbalance because these women can be sentenced to 3 years tomorrow. In fact, tomorrow, apparently the judges, it is said that she's ready to make a final decision. So I think that is the greatest distinction, that we have it coming from the legal system and also from the president of the Russian Federation.
And, of course, this judge, Nina Kresheva, refused to allow any mention of Putin in the trial, even though the young women have protested against him.
Oh, and the whole and that song that they were singing is all about Putin, that he's afraid of protests Mother of God, please take Putin away. It is sort of a feminist prayer, so to speak. And exactly, and that makes it even more farcical because it's a huge elephant in the room that we are not supposed to mention by name, but we do know what the conversation is about and what the whole story is about.
Well, as I mentioned in the opening, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was railroaded by Putin for daring to engage in politics in Russia, he described this trial as a medieval inquisition. Apparently, he at least has a website. And that leads me that is the last hope, isn't it? I mean, everybody in Russia gets pro-Putin information in the press. There's virtually no other newspaper, except for, I think, Novaya Gazeta, that prints anything like the news. And then you've got all of television controlled by Putin. So the last frontier of information seems to be the Internet. And Putin is moving on that.
Well, that is actually not entirely true. Some of it is. Putin controls the TV. He really doesn't control the news, or he doesn't really care to control the newspapers that much because the readership is not as important. I mean, we all know from propaganda that the images are more important than words, and certainly in contemporary universe. So there are other outlets like the New Times and even those newspapers that are favorable or not favorable, they're not anti-Putin necessarily. They still can print some very very biting op-eds. So that's not the point. The point is that Putin is always going for the most outreach. So for 10 years it was TV, and now it seems to be getting the internet. And so they're trying to figure out how to address this issue. Although I still would like to remind the listeners that Russia is as medieval as it is, and I totally agree with Khodorkovsky. It is still a far cry from the Chinese system to manipulate the World Wide Web information.
Well, the one thing that the Chinese and Putin have in common is this wonderful holdover from the communist era, the word hooligan and hooliganism, which is a grab bag term for anybody that they want to railroad. And that is what's being applied to these young women, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it is actually, it's a fantastic point that you just made, because the word hooligan really disappeared from the Russian language for a really long time, because during the Yeltsin era in the 90s, after communism collapsed, hooligan didn't seem like it is such an insult, but it is indeed. I remember in the Soviet Union, hooligan was grounds for prosecution. In fact, a lot of dissidents of the 70s were accused of being hooligans and those without jobs, whatever, parasites.
So
these were the grounds for offense. And it did seem like a lot of things that we experienced in the Soviet Union and thought they were gone forever in 1991, they seemed to come back after 2000 under Putin.
Again, I'm speaking with Nina Krusheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. And she's the author of the forthcoming book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And we're talking about the likely conviction tomorrow of the three young women of the Russian punk rock group Pussy Riot, who may well face 3 years, 3 years in jail, having already spent 5 months in prison. They've also, Putin has gone after Navalny as well, hasn't he? The young sort of nationalist protester, using, I think, a similar tactic that the communist Chinese are using on the great artist Ai Weiwei. You know, aren't they charging him with fraudulent back taxes?
The same thing that, I mean, in a sense, the same thing that he did with Mikhail Khodorkovsky, whom you quoted.
Yeah.
Because it does seem to be this new tactic is to use the accuse everybody of being being a thief and prosecute people on that charge, which also yet again is a great reminder of the Soviet times, not that the Soviets were caring about money that much, but they always imagined that their enemy or the people they perceive as enemy would be doing the same thing as they're doing. That is really quite remarkable that the Putin system always accuses everybody of being a thief. And, you know, I don't have proof of that, but there have been investigations by journalists and, you know, arguably Putin, one of the richest men in the world. So, of course, he only thinks in this kind of terms, is that if I stole, somebody else might be stealing either. But with Navalny, it's as idiotic as it is with Pussy Riot, because he already was investigated for stealing some forest, something that I can't even understand what it is exactly he's accused of, because it's so crazy. And it was already that investigation was closed in 2009 for the lack of evidence, and now it's open all over again. I mean, Putin was a KGB man. He at least should invent something better, because it is, if it weren't that horrible and tragic and sad, it would be remarkably farcical what he does.
Well, of course, Navalny came up with a great description of United Russia, Putin's rubber stamp party, as the party of thieves and swindlers. But I've been looking into some of the reports about Putin's finances and the extent to which Roman Abramovich in London is his bag man, and he's appointed his old KGB cronies to head up the big oil and gas monopolies that he's taken over. There is a possibility that if and when he ever retires, because he may well reappoint himself for another 12 years, who knows? But if and when he ever retires, he may well end up one of the richest men on the planet.
Well, and I actually hope that as the Iranian finances are being investigated by the West, I think that it is really about time to start investigating the Russian finances instead of allowing this crooks and thieves live in London and buy out property and whatnot. So I hope if Putin retires, actually they will be if I don't imagine that his life is going to be that peachy. That's why he's staying on, because who knows what is going to happen to him when he's out of the Kremlin. But if he does, then I really hope the investigation comes in and his own crimes will be exposed.
Well, Nina Krusheva, he apparently, one of the reasons he's sticking so assiduously to the Syrian dictator Assad is that, my understanding is that Putin honestly believes he's just as delusional as Assad is. Assad believes that the entire uprising against him by 80% of his own people is a foreign plot, and that somehow the CIA is paying these young Syrians to stand in the street and get shot by snipers and tanks. Putin apparently similarly believes that the protests in Russia, and in particular in Moscow, against him are all being organized by Hillary Clinton. So, it's pretty delusional, isn't it? He's not, apparently, this is not cynicism on his part. My understanding is that he actually believes this.
Well, to a certain degree, and I wouldn't entirely compare the Russian situation, at least not now, not yet, to Assad. I mean, there's certainly Putin is fearful of Assad's fate, but also we have to remember that that actually about 60% of the Russian population did vote for him. Most of reports of protests did come out of big cities, and it is true that in cities his popularity is, I don't know, maybe 20%, 30 at best. But outside of big cities, in fact, he is rather popular, not because he's such a good president or popular as somebody that people now like, but because, you know, as Russians always say, traditionally, better the devil we know. So in the provinces, which is about 60% of the population, they did vote for him. So his situation for now is still better than Assad. But if he plans to stay for another 12 years, that certainly is going to change. In fact, I believe that it's changing by the minute, and it is no longer 60. It's probably now 50, and then it's going to get less and less and less. But he does, as we talked about at the beginning, he does share... he does seem to have affinity with the worst dictators that universe ever created, either past or present, and that really should give us pause in where Russia belongs and what the future holds.
So the 60% that support Putin, is that just an example of the old sort of eternal divide between the educated urban Russians and the so-called Narod?
To a certain extent, it is, and also, you know, sort of exactly the lifestyle that people have been experiencing, the cities versus smaller towns or villages, for that matter. But to some extent, there's also kind of broader horizon that the city people supposedly have versus those who are in the provinces and don't see as much of the world as the city people do. And in fact, I actually talk to people in various regions, especially in Kaluga region, which is about 4 or 5 hours by car west of Moscow, and they would tell me that no, we don't like Putin, but you know who else? There is no other candidate, and at least Russia is respected now, which is basically the display of power that Putin does is for those people in the provinces, because this muscle playing is very important, you know, that we all follow the Olympics, and it was really interesting to watch that the first medals that the Russians got were the judo medals, the first three medals that Russia got. This judo is that muscle display that Putin himself is very proud of. It's his sport. So the provinces and the population there seem to uphold to this view. But once again, as I said, I think the further it goes, the less support they would probably give Putin, because the longer you stay like this in a unhappening environment, which Russia is, with a stagnant environment, the less you really can hold the country together.
Well, of course, his vanity is such that I understand he's had some Botox work, but
he had a facelift. He had a full facelift. It's not just Botox. It's the
right.
Full
but are you, but. I've noticed some people out here have had one too many, the cut too many.
Oh, absolutely. He's very, no offense to Elizabeth Taylor. She was a wonderful actress and a woman, so she has the right to be vain, but he really is kind of that. I mean, that's what he was offering during the elections. That's what he was offering his people, is that, look at me, look, I am what I am. He really he turned into a very vain, very vain human being. I guess he always has been that. I mean, he was just sort of that small man who all of a sudden discovered his bigness and just can't get over it. But no, the Botox really didn't go well with people generally. I mean, that's how he lost most of us. I mean, most of 40%.
Well, Nina, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Kresheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, and she was a research fellow at the School of Historical Studies of the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton University, and served as deputy editor of the East European Constitutional Review at the NYU School of Law. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and she's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the meetings today between the Syrian dictator and his Iranian ally. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashimi, who's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashimi.
Glad to be with you again.
And the meeting between the Syrian beleaguered and besieged Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and the chief security or head of Iran's security, Saeed Jalili, obviously the Iranian declarations coming out of that, that Iran's pledging support for a vital partner. Just separate the rhetoric from the reality, if you can, Nader. What can Iran do to rescue Assad?
Well, there's not much that they can do to, I think, save the Assad regime, whose days are really numbered. And it's not a question of if the regime will fall, but really, you know, just when. So I think the regime is there to pledge sort of support to its closest ally in the region. Of course, there's an issue of these 48 Iranian alleged pilgrims, and I put pilgrims in quotation marks because it's not really clear how many of them are legitimate pilgrims and how many of them are representatives and agents of the Islamic Republican Guard Corps. So, Iran has sent a high-level representative, effectively a spokesperson, a person who's been personally chosen by Iran's supreme leader to act as his representative in Syria to pledge support to the Assad regime. So I don't think there's much that it can do. The big question that we don't know, and we probably won't know until the Assad regime falls, is to what extent that the Iranian regime has actually been supporting the Syrian regime. It's generally assumed that there's been considerable, significant, and deep support, but the extent and the depth of that support is unknown, largely because both countries are, you know, repressive, authoritarian regimes, and there's not an open paper trail.
Well, Mr. Jalili, the Iran's security chief, said that Iran will not allow the axis of resistance to be broken in any way. Now, apparently, the Axis resistance refers to Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and the Palestinian group Hamas in Gaza, which I understand Hamas is already breaking away from Iran's orbit.
That's true. Yeah, they've moved their offices out of Damascus, and they're moving to Cairo. So you're right. That's what the axis of resistance means in the rhetoric of the Iranian regime. It effectively means those countries and those political forces that are allied with the Islamic Republic of Iran. But what's, of course, lost in that phrase, the axis of resistance, is it assumes that there's only one form of resistance that's acceptable. In other words, the assumption is that the only form of resistance is resistance to Western and European and Israeli policy in the region, ignoring the fact that the bigger issue that I think the people of the region are now facing as a result of the Arab Spring is that there's another force that needs to be resisted, and that's the political tyrannies that rule over the peoples of the Middle East, of which Bashar Assad's regime is probably the most notorious, given its crimes against humanity and war crimes that it's been inflicting over its own citizens over the last 17 months. But that form of resistance, of course, does not bother the clerics in Iran. They're very, very comfortable in perpetuating and supporting the Assad regime. So it's really, you know, if one wants to just take a step back, it's really an attempt by the Iranian government to come to the support of its closest ally. One of the dimensions of the Syrian conflict, and it's important to state that the primary, most important, you know, founding, I think, issue with respect to Syria is the fact that there's a popular struggle against the 42-year-old dictatorship. But there's also a regional dynamic that's sort of fueling this conflict, and that is the rivalry between the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies, and Saudi Arabia and its allies in the region. And the big sort of key event here that has shifted the balance of power was the 2003 American invasion of Iraq that resulted in the rise of Shi'i political parties that are friendly toward Iran. And I think the Saudis and their allies in the Gulf Cooperation Council are hoping that by overthrowing Assad, they can readjust that balance of power, remove an important ally from Iran's camp and shift it back into the Saudi camp.
Again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashimi. He's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. So we don't really know the extent. We know that the Saudis are furious with the George W. Bush regime for taking down the Sunni dictatorship in Iraq and allowing essentially Iran to replace it through a very friendly Shia regime in Baghdad that we, the United States, essentially installed with at the cost of great blood and treasure. Now, Iraq has been fairly unstable since then, and I'm just wondering the extent to which the Saudi hand is in that destabilization, allegedly at the hands of al-Qaeda, but you know, how do all these fighters suddenly show up in Syria, you know, from Chechnya and all over the place? I mean,
you're right. I mean, it's important to realize that the bulk of the Free Syrian Army, the overwhelming majority of the men who are involved in the armed resistance against the Assad regime, are local citizens of Syria, people who have organized themselves in their own communities and they're fighting a tyrannical regime. But part of the story, and I think this gets often exaggerated in terms of the extent of the support, is there is a radical jihadi Salafi sort of current that is at play here. They're responsible for their own human rights violations. They've come over from the border in Iraq where they have been involved in their own militant activity over the last 10 years approximately. And it's also this conflict, because it's been ongoing, because it's been unresolved, has been a magnet. It's become another sort of Afghanistan in many ways, recruiting and drawing in radical elements from across the Islamic world, very much in a similar way to the way Afghanistan did during the 1980s. And it's a lot of these sort of radical groups that have been responsible for arresting foreign nationals, for perpetuating atrocities, for some extremist activity. And this sort of highlights, I think, the fact that the longer this conflict in Syria goes unresolved, the more it destabilizes Syria, the more it acts as a magnet for these extremist groups who can gather there to perpetuate and pursue their own radical ideology. And the tragedy of this, of course, is it, of course, undermines and it tarnishes the very important popular struggle that's being waged by the majority of Syrians against the family dictatorship run by the Assad family.
So let's turn, Nada Hashimi, to the capture of 48 Iranian so-called pilgrims by the Free Syrian Army, or elements of the Free Syrian Army. Already the same head of Iran's National Security Council that we've been speaking about, Mr. Jalili, said that he will use all means possible to win their freedom. Apparently the Iranians have sent a letter to the U.S. administration accusing them of being the manifest sponsor of terrorist groups in Syria and holding the U.S. responsible for the captive's safety. Apparently some of these so-called pilgrims have been killed by the Syrian army, who are bombarding wherever it is they're being held. What's your sense? I mean, first of all, I can't understand how religious pilgrims could show up in a country at war. That doesn't ring true.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, it's highly irresponsible of the Islamic Republic of Iran to send pilgrims into the middle of a war zone. Now, granted that the conflict in Syria over the last month or so has significantly deteriorated, parts of the country, if you follow the news reports, seem perfectly calm. Others, like the city of Aleppo today as we speak, are war zones. So, I mean, there's a question here as to why did the Islamic Republic send pilgrims to the middle of an ongoing civil war? And then the second big question is, who exactly constitutes this group of pilgrims? Are they legitimate pilgrims, or are they agents and members of Iran's Islamic Republican Guard Corps? I suspect that it's a combination of both. Iran has huge, you know, strategic interests in Syria. It's very convenient for the regime to send its agents to Syria under the guise of being pilgrims. That's a sort of a convenient cover. But of course, it wouldn't be a surprise to me or any, I think, serious analyst to think that part of this group constitutes people who are involved with Iran's military and security intelligence services, who are really up to no good. They're effectively in Syria to preserve and support a criminal regime that's perpetuating gross atrocities on its own population. So in that sense, I think the Iranian regime has a lot to answer for, especially if it can be proven that the part of this group constitutes members of the Islamic Republican Guard Corps.
Well, previously I've spoken with a number of representatives of the Free Syrian Army, at least the political representatives, and for some time now they've been saying that Iran is in many ways directing Assad's response to the insurrection, and Iranian drones have been used, etc. I don't know, you know, obviously you can't entirely trust what either side's saying in this civil war.
Right.
But this is not exactly news, the involvement of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Apparently they, some time ago, when the insurrection first started, they brought in monitoring equipment that tracks down cell phones and websites, etc., and identifies critics of the regime. And, of course, we know what a grisly end will happen to anybody who opposes the Assads.
Right, yeah, well, several points here. One, first and foremost, the Assad regime does not need help from anyone in the world, particularly Iran, in terms of how to crack down on political opposition within Syria. They have a very long and sordid track record of dealing with their own population in a very brutal manner, so they don't really need any lessons here or help from Iran. So I think the claims that somehow that the Iranian regime or the Revolutionary Guard Corps of the Islamic Republic are somehow directing the war against the Free Syrian Army and the Arab Spring Uprising is exaggerated. The second point is we don't really know the extent and the depth of Iranian involvement. I suspect that it's quite deep, and I suspect that Iran has brought to Syria, as you just indicated, a lot of the lessons that it has learned from the crackdown on the Green Movement in Iran in 2009, particularly the ability of the Iranian regime to track internet transmissions, cell phone transmissions, to locate where the opposition is organizing and coalescing, and to really crack down hard. That's what the Iranian regime did with a lot of ruthlessness and efficiency in 2009, 2010, and I think it's been sharing that technology with the Syrian regime. The good news in all of this is that it seems not to be working in the case of Syria, that despite the best efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran to support its ally in Damascus, that they have been they've had a very difficult time in really, you know, cracking down and preventing the uprising from continuing. So, I mean, that's my reading on the level of interaction and support. I think we're going to have to really wait until there are democratic transitions in both Syria and Iran, and there's an opening of the archives, and people are willing to come forward without fear and can really reveal to, you know, future historians, to the general public, exactly what was taking place, the type and depth and the extent of the relations between Assad in Syria and Khamenei in Iran with respect to collaboration on questions of intelligence gathering, crackdown, opposition work, etc. So we really don't know, but I think it's important to not exaggerate the extent here of the role that Iran is playing. It's an ally, it's supporting them, but you know, it's clearly not directing or as I said before, the Syrian regime does not need to take any lessons from, you know, Iran in terms of how to treat its own population. It's done quite a sufficient and very ruthless job over the last 42 years.
Again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashimi, who's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Now, we mentioned earlier that Iran has essentially lost out with Hamas, who have largely transitioned to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt for their support and mentorship, if you will. But my understanding, talking to people in Lebanon, is that Hezbollah is also losing out with its sympathy. For some time, Hezbollah had gained the respect of a lot of people in Lebanon, including some of its traditional enemies, because they were the ones that were standing up against Israel. Right. Apparently, that's been considerably tarnished because of their support for the Assads. Refugees are pouring in from Syria. And they're not too happy about what's happening there. What's your understanding about what's going to happen to Hezbollah when the Assads fall? Let's start with that question.
Sure, yeah, you're right. I mean, you're putting your finger on a very important development that has been taking place here, and that is the loss in prestige and support and popularity that the Islamic Republic of Iran had and that Hezbollah had within the broader Sunni Arab world. Hezbollah and Iran, to a lesser extent, were considered to be, you know, champions of resistance, champions of the human rights and the political rights of the Palestinians. And you know, if you look at opinion polls not too long ago, Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, was the most popular Arab political leader. Ahmadinejad sort of, you know, was up there in support, as was Hafez Assad, largely because of their, you know, support for Hezbollah and support for the Palestinians and their resistance to Israeli policies in the region. But as a result of the Arab Spring and as a result of the crackdown in Syria, and as a direct result of a political decision that both Hezbollah and the leaders in Iran have taken to support the Assad regime as opposed to the opposition on the streets of Syria, they've lost a lot of credibility and support. And this is a huge blow to the prestige of Hezbollah, which at one time could claim to sort of stand on some moral high ground. Now it's actually on the other side of the so-called resistance or democratic barricades because of its support for Assad's regime. And so this is going to actually lead to considerable, I think, regional transformations. It's going to reorient the political map of the Middle East. It'll have huge consequences for Hezbollah's role in the politics of Lebanon and the politics of the broader Arab world. And of course, with respect to Iran is, I think, one of the things why it's so fearful and why I think it's one of the big losers in the Arab Spring, is because Iran has invested a lot of time and money and energy in reaching out and telling the Sunni Arab world that we are the legitimate sort of leaders of the Islamic world. We are the ones who are standing up for the plight of the Palestinians and the plight of the Lebanese, not the other leaders of the Middle East. But now, because of its very vocal stance, as we see today, you know, with respect to what is happening in Damascus as we speak. Iran has made a decision, and it's made a decision that has basically put it against the popular, the tide of popular opinion within the Arab world, which is strongly supportive of the uprising in Syria and strongly critical of those governments, those forces that are supporting the Assad regime. So this is going to have, you know, serious consequences for both Hezbollah and Iran in the coming years.
Well, of course, there is a red line in this, from my understanding, and that is that if the Assads were to transfer some or all of their chemical arsenal, say, to Hezbollah, that might invite Israeli intervention. Of course, remember, during the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein tried to pick a fight with the Israelis by firing Scud missiles in the hope that Israel would intervene against him and therefore destroy the coalition led by the United States. Is there a possibility of any repeat along those lines?
No, I think those claims about, you know, chemical weapons in Syria falling into the wrong hands, possibly falling into the hands of Hezbollah, which then they can use against Israel, thus widening this conflict. I think those claims are completely exaggerated and distorted, and for one primary reason. Hezbollah does not need to rely on Syria to obtain chemical weapons. It can rely on its closest ally and supporter, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has its own, you know, chemical weapons capabilities. It could easily give those chemical weapons to Hezbollah without even involving Syria, perhaps at best as a transport route, but there's other ways of, you know, getting armaments to Hezbollah. So I think this is an exaggerated claim that, you know, and a distortion, I think, of really of what really matters in this conflict. You know, I think those chemical weapons are in the hands of the Assad regime, and the big question is not whether they'll end up in the hands of Hezbollah, but whether in its dying days the regime in Damascus will use chemical weapons on its own civilians in order to preserve itself. That's, I think, the big question.
Well, just in closing, Nader Hashemi, obviously there are some attempts probably going on behind the scenes, one would imagine, to ease Assad out of there and give him asylum. Russia, of course, seems to be the number one candidate for that. Do you think that there is anything that's going to happen between the kind of Gotterdammerung, you know, Samson option of bringing the whole thing down, including using chemical weapons on the part of the Assads, or will, I know he's delusional and he's not too bright apparently, but do you think at some point or other, when the writing's on the wall, he'll figure, I can go off and live somewhere with my billions that I've stolen from the Syrian people?
It's a good question, you know. It's a good question. No one, I think, really knows the answer to that question. Will Bashar Assad's fate be that of you know, Tunisia's Ben Ali, where he flees with his millions and ends up in some safe country, or will he suffer the fate of Muammar Gaddafi, where he's pulled out of some sewer and he's killed by an enraged group of his own citizens? We're not. I think it's too early to speculate on that. It's a good question. If he does decide to flee, he really has two places to go. Possibly Russia. The other is the Islamic Republic of Iran. But of course, you know, if Iran takes him in, that further entrenches and diminishes Iran's regional credibility on the Arab street, because it's effectively holding and coddling this man who's viewed as a tyrant, and that's not in Iran's long-term strategic interest. So, you know, how this regime is going to come to an end and where its head of state is going to end up is open to speculation, and I think no one really knows the answer to that. I think we just have to wait and see.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Nader Hashemi.
Glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. And he's the co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the Hospital Corporation of America has been defrauding Medicare and endangering the lives of their patients.
when we see these acts against humanity. We're each for each and each world leader. Shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see and some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Cause I know what's in me. I don't need no doctor, no, no. Cause I know what's in me. Yeah. Been too long away from my bed. Coming down in a misery.
Yeah. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Evan Weissman, who's a retired cardiologist who lives in Greater Atlanta. He's a graduate of Yale and Emory Universities and has practiced for the past 40 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Evan Weissman.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And the New York Times is carrying a lead article in Tuesday's paper about the Hospital Corporation of America profiting from questionable cardiac procedures. This is a company that has 163 hospitals and 110 surgery centers with annual revenues of almost $30 billion in 2011 and with profits of $2.5 billion. And apparently a fifth of its income comes from Florida, where there's a large retiree population, and they've been apparently doing a lot of unnecessary operations down there.
That appears to be the case. It's not unusual.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think in the private healthcare system, for profit hospitals, there have been cases in the past in which these for-profit hospitals, which have very little overseeing of them, pretty much often their major motive is not to really provide services for patients and take good care of patients, but to make money. That's in distinction to other hospitals, which are for not-for-profit hospitals, in which this is much less likely to occur. In 2003, Tenet Hospital had a hospital in Redding, California, in which if you're car happens to break down, you generally wind up with a zipper on your chest. People were having unnecessary heart surgery, unnecessary cardiac catheterizations, unnecessary heart procedures. In one case, a gentleman stayed over at that house at that city, wound up having a heart catheterization, was told he needed to have urgent heart surgery. For some reason or another, he did not have that done, and when he showed his x-rays to other doctors, they said there's nothing wrong at all with the blood flow to your heart. I had three different doctors who saw him afterwards.
So you're saying that anybody that happened to, it sounds like that the movie Psycho, you know, showing up at the wrong motel, if you went into Redding, California, and anything happened to you, and you went into a hospital.
The wrong hospital. They have two hospitals. There's one that's not for profit, and that practice did not occur at that hospital. It was the Tenet Hospital that it occurred at. And Tenet was, as the article in the New York Times pointed out, had to pay a substantial penalty for the practices that they allowed to occur in that hospital.
Well, so did HCA, though. HCA, the Health Corporation of America, paid out $1.7 billion in fines to settle charges of defrauding the government in 2000.
That is correct, and both of them are private for-hospital chains. The problem is that if you put a cardiac facility into a small community, small isolated community, a lot of practices may then go on which are very questionable, actually fraudulent, and people have no oversight over that. If a patient, if if I were in a small community and for some reason I wound up in a heart hospital or a member of my family, I wouldn't have that kind of procedure done at that place because there's no one to answer to. The doctors can look at an X-ray, say that there's a blockage there, and proceed to act on that, and you have no knowledge of that yourself. You're just not that wise. Every little hospital in Florida, in every little isolated community, does not need to have the ability to perform angioplasty or even cardiac catheterization.
And you're saying that because these are small hospitals, there aren't sufficient checks and balances from other colleagues who would notice these procedures.
That's right. It's much less likely to occur if in metropolitan areas, and particularly if the metropolitan area happens to have a nearby medical school, so that other people can check these things out. The patients are a tremendous disadvantage. They have no way of knowing that this information that they're being given is incorrect and actually fraudulent.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Evan Weissman, who's a retired cardiologist who lives in the greater Atlanta area. He's a graduate of Yale and Emory University and has practiced for the past 40 years. Now, these procedures that were done by the Health Corporation of America, and because, again, they were previously sued for defrauding the government back in 2000, and apparently they had to pay out $1.7 billion in fines then, but apparently they're back at it, defrauding the government. And apparently the two main procedures that they use irresponsibly and unnecessarily are diagnostic catheterization and cardiac stents. So just tell us exactly what they are, because we, the taxpayers, through Medicare, pay these hospitals about $3,000 for the former and $10,000 for the latter.
That's correct. Well, a heart catheterization is when a tube is placed into the heart, and in this case, mostly into the coronary arteries, and dye is injected to see whether or not there's any blockage in those arteries. That's a diagnostic test. A angioplasty or a stent is put in if they find a blockage and it's felt to be the cause of the patient's symptoms. So it requires judgment as to who gets the heart catheterization. In other words, not everyone who has a heart needs a heart catheterization. And who requires an angioplasty or a stent. Because if there's no disease, then you don't need to have a stent put in. As a matter of fact, even if you do have disease, the guidelines are that you should be treated with medicine first, and if your symptoms do not respond, then to maximal medical therapy, then a stent is warranted. So it doesn't really occur necessarily that if you have a blockage that you need to have a stent put in. But I doubt that was observed in these cases.
Well, what I find extraordinary here, Dr. Weissman, is that this has been happening in Florida, and the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, he headed a similar big hospital chain, and he was fined for fraudulent practices. His company was, and he had to leave the company. And they paid a record fine, I think several billion, about $6 billion.
That is correct. And again, it's the private, for-profit hospitals that seem to be the culprit in these situations. Because the hospital gets remunerated by the government for the number of procedures that are being done. And the hospital, as this article in the New York Times pointed out, mentioned that one of their doctors had brought in a great deal of income, and they were very proud of the fact that he was able to do that. Well, that should not be a reason for a doctor to receive accolades from the hospital. Another doctor in this article says he wasn't being paid by the hospital, and he probably wasn't being paid by the hospital. But my question is, was he receiving perks from that hospital? because there are many ways that hospitals can reward you. For instance, they can provide you transportation, like a helicopter to go to certain places. They can send you on vacations, and I'm sure they do. And they can ask, they can allow you to use their facilities, such as ski condominiums and things of that nature. And they can also make it less necessary for you to do things that most other doctors are required to do, such as keeping their charts up to date. They can be much more lax about that if the doctor is bringing them in sufficient income.
Well, Dr. Weissman, the reason I brought up Governor Rick Scott of Florida is that these practices have been taking place in small hospitals in Florida, and he's the governor of the state, and he's already not a convicted felon, but he certainly, I think he is actually a convicted felon, but he certainly paid the biggest fine in history for his criminal practices as the head of a big health company. I'm just wondering whether somehow he was setting the tone. The New York Times didn't make any connections, but I was just making that connection.
Well, I concur with that. I am sure that he is one of the people who's against regulatory agencies looking over the shoulder of doctors and making sure that they are practicing the kind of medicine they should be practicing. So many times we hear that these regulators are getting in the way of the doctor's way to practice medicine. But this is a way of protecting our patients, and I would want to be protected by someone who knew more than I did about whether or not these hospitals were actually practicing ethically. And I'm sure that Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, does not like regulations being brought down on almost anything, and particularly on medical facilities.
Well, not only do patients need to be protected from unnecessary operations, it appears, also the taxpayer needs to be protected from the unnecessary expense to Medicare.
Well, that's true, because we all know this is a very expensive system, and if hospitals and doctors and everyone else wasn't remunerated for each type of procedure that was done, but there was some more general fee that was just given to the hospital, I think that this kind of practice would, first of all, be a lot less frequent, and second of all, I think there'd be a lot less private industry investing in medicine because it wouldn't be as profitable for them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Evan Weissman.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Evan Weissman, who's a retired cardiologist who lives in the greater Atlanta area. He's a graduate of Yale and Emory Universities and has practiced for the past 40 years. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Brooke Peterson and Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.